What if the most intimate parts of who you are, your desires, your sense of self, even your fantasies, aren't truly your own? What if they're structured by invisible codes you never consciously chose? This unsettling proposition lies at the heart of Jacques Lacan's radical reimagining of psychoanalysis. Far from being an obscure intellectual curiosity, Lacan's ideas have shaped everything from film theory to political analysis, influencing cultural icons like David Lynch while remaining relevant in clinical practice worldwide. Though notoriously difficult to grasp, his insights offer something profound, a framework for understanding the hidden structures shaping our experiences of love, desire, and identity. Think of it this way. We believe we're speaking, but language is actually speaking through us. Lacan's Big Other describes the symbolic order, language, social norms, shared meanings that we inhabit without fully realizing it. Think of a chess game. The rules represent this symbolic order. Piece names represent our imaginary identifications, and unpredictable circumstances represent the traumatic real. Language isn't merely a tool we use. It colonizes us from within, restructuring our entire being. Consider empty gestures that maintain social bonds, offering something you expect to be refused, or asking, "How are you?" without wanting a real answer. These rituals create social reality itself. A sociopath's failure is structural. Treating language as purely instrumental misses how it actually functions. Even mundane objects carry ideological weight. A city dweller's Land Rover signals a down-to-earth attitude rather than practical necessity. Different toilet designs reflect cultural attitudes. German models display excrement for inspection. French designs quickly hide it, while American toilets create a floating compromise, each mirroring distinct national approaches to confronting reality. Ever recorded a TV show you never watched but felt satisfied it was saved? This reveals interpassivity, where objects or others experience emotions on our behalf. In ancient Greek theater, the chorus handled emotional reactions, allowing audiences to remain detached. Similar examples include hired mourners at funerals, Tibetan prayer wheels that pray mechanically, or canned laughter that laughs for us. While contemporary culture celebrates interactivity, its uncanny double is interpassivity, where objects take over our passive enjoyment. VCR owners compulsively recorded films they never watched, gaining satisfaction merely from knowing the films existed. The obsessional neurotic demonstrates false activity, frantically talking to prevent real confrontation. Similarly, pseudo-activity in progressive politics often ensures nothing truly changes. We engage in frenetic action precisely to avoid genuine transformation. The paradox of Protestant predestination illustrates this. Theology claiming our fate is predetermined actually triggered unprecedented productive activity, legitimizing capitalism through theological fatalism. Lacan's Big Other presents a paradox. Is it the anonymous symbolic order, or another subject confronting us with radical alterity? The mystery emerges when the symbolic order becomes subjectivized, when God or history seems to directly address us. This appears in everyday life, feeling watched by society, sensing higher purpose in coincidences, wondering why someone loves you. The formula, desire is the other's desire, means our desires are predetermined by the symbolic order. Even transgression depends on what it transgresses, and that we desire only because we experience the other as desiring. Fashion illustrates this perfectly. People desire objects not for inherent value, but because others appear to desire them. Being loved is traumatic because it forces us to confront the gap between our determinate being and the unfathomable X in us that causes love. When someone unexpectedly declares passionate love, the first reaction is often that something obscene and intrusive is being forced upon us. This explains why people react with anxiety or hostility to genuine love. It confronts them with an image of themselves they're not ready to acknowledge. The Jewish injunction to love your neighbor as yourself obscures the radical otherness beneath the mirror image of the neighbor. Jewish law keeps neighbors at proper distance, shielding us from the monstrosity next door. With Kant's philosophical revolution, the excess to be fought becomes immanent to subjectivity itself. Pre-Kantian thought saw madness as animal passions overtaking humanity. With Kant, madness signals the unconstrained explosion of humanity's very core. German idealism uses the metaphor of night of the world for subjectivity, representing not the absence of rationality, but the terrifying depths where reason and madness intertwine. Fantasy teaches us how to desire by answering the enigma of the other's desire. The real problem isn't fantasizing about the unattainable, it's knowing what we want at all. This relates to Lacan's paradox that there is no sexual relationship, no universal guarantee of harmonious sexual relations. Each subject must invent their own fantasy formula that regulates their desire. Crucially, fantasy stages not our own desire, but the other's. The original question isn't, what do I want, but what do others want from me? Even Freud's daughter fantasizing about strawberry cake was forming an identity to satisfy her parents. Since sexuality brings us closest to another's intimacy, sexual enjoyment is real for Lacan, traumatic in its intensity, yet impossible to fully comprehend. Contact with a flesh and blood other is inherently traumatic and sustainable only when they enter our fantasy frame. Fantasy is objectively subjective, how things actually seem to you, even if they don't consciously seem that way. This is the Freudian unconscious, what Lacan calls knowledge that doesn't know itself. Rumsfeld spoke of known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, but missed the crucial fourth term, unknown knowns, things we don't know that we know, the unconscious fantasies structuring our reality. Lacan's equation reveals enjoyment as a twisted ethical duty imposed by the superego, an anti-ethical agency operating through insatiable demands. Consider visiting grandmother. The authoritarian father's direct command preserves inner freedom through clear obligation. The permissive father's, go only if you really want to, is more oppressive, requiring not just compliance, but voluntary desire, eliminating even the freedom to resent. Modern society's paradox, the fall of oppressive authority produces stricter prohibitions. Lacan's formula isn't God is dead, but God is unconscious. We think we've abandoned belief, yet unconsciously perpetuate new prohibitions. Today's subject appears as a tolerant hedonist pursuing happiness, but their unconscious harbors deep prohibitions. What's repressed isn't illicit desire, but the prohibitions themselves. We're bombarded by injunctions to enjoy, sexual performance, professional achievement, wellness. Enjoyment becomes a strange duty. People feel guilty not for violating moral inhibitions, but for failing to enjoy sufficiently. Psychoanalysis provides rare space where this pressure can be questioned. In our age of certainty, where fundamentalists claim direct knowledge of divine will and rationalists claim direct knowledge of scientific truth, we've lost something precious, the ability to truly believe. Belief isn't knowledge. It's a groundless decision that can't be based on positive facts. Religious fundamentalists don't actually believe. They know directly, treating religious statements as quasi-empirical facts. This appears in extremists and certain political leaders who claim their acts are directly guided by higher will, not faith, but abdication of ethical responsibility. The true danger of fundamentalism isn't its threat to secular knowledge, but its threat to authentic belief itself. Anne Frank's assertion that there's a divine spark of goodness in every human being exemplifies true belief as an ethical axiom. Not provable, not based on evidence, but a decision structuring how we encounter the world. Paradoxically, humanists stand for belief, while fundamentalists stand for knowledge. Lacan's insights invite you to examine the invisible structures shaping your experiences. When you feel desire, ask, whose desire is this really? When you feel guilty, ask, what impossible demand am I trying to satisfy? In recognizing how language, fantasy, and the symbolic order structure your inner life, you don't gain mastery, but you might gain something more valuable, the freedom to recognize that you were never fully in control to begin with, and that this lack of control is the very condition of your humanity.